windy North Carolina beach for just shy of 100 seconds. The Wright brothers demonstrated that a heavier-than-air, self-propelled vehicle could fly.
Balance yourself like a bird on a beam in the air. She goes, there she goes, up, up, a little bit higher. Oh my, the moon is on fire, come Josephine.
The moment was electric, and its importance widely understood.
Goodbye.
Say, don't you know you can't get Josephine with that old corny jive of 1917?
Almost immediately, there was an explosion of interest in this newfound technology of manned flight, and a gaggle of innovators began to build upon it. At the time the Wright brothers invented the airplane, American law held that a property owner presumptively owned not just the surface of his land, but all the land below, down to the center of the earth, and all the space above, to an indefinite extent, upwards. For many years, scholars had puzzled about how to best interpret the idea that rights in land ran to the heavens. Did that mean that you owned the stars? Could you prosecute geese for their willful and regular trespass? Then came airplanes, and for the first time, this principle of American law, deep within the foundations of our tradition, and acknowledged by the most important legal thinkers of our past, mattered. If my land reaches to the heavens, what happens when United flies over my field? Do I have the right to banish it from my property? Am I allowed to enter into an exclusive license with Delta Airlines? Could we set up an auction to decide how much these rights are worth? In 1945, these questions became a federal case, when North Carolina farmers Thomas Lee and Tiny Cosby started losing chickens because of low-flying military aircraft. The terrified chickens apparently flew into the barn walls and died. The Cosbys filed a lawsuit saying that the government was trespassing on their land. The airplanes, of course, never touched the surface of the Cosbys' land. But if, as Blackstone, Kent, and Koch had said, their land reached to an indefinite extent upwards, then the government was trespassing on their property, and the Cosbys wanted it to stop. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the Cosbys' case. Congress had declared the airways public, but if one's property really extended to the heavens, then Congress's declaration could well have been an unconstitutional taking of property without compensation. The court acknowledged that it is ancient doctrine that common law ownership of the land extended to the periphery of the universe. But Justice Douglas had no patience for ancient doctrine. In a single paragraph, hundreds of years of property law were erased. As he wrote for the court, "The doctrine has no place in the modern world. The air is a public highway, as Congress has declared. Were that not true, every transcontinental flight would subject the operator to countless trespass suits. Common sense revolts at the idea. To recognize such private claims to the airspace would clog these highways, seriously interfere with their control and development in the public interest, and transfer into private ownership that to which only the public has a just claim. Common sense revolts at the idea." This is how the law usually works. Not often this abruptly or impatiently, but eventually this is how it works. It was Douglas's style not to dither. Other justices would have blathered on for pages to reach the conclusion that Douglas holds in a single line, "Common sense revolts at the idea." But whether it takes pages or a few words, it is the special genius of a common law system, as ours is, that the law adjusts to the technologies of the time. And as it adjusts, it changes. Ideas that were as solid as rock in one age crumble in another. Or at least, this is how things happen when there's no one powerful on the other side of the change. The Cosbys were just farmers, and though there were no doubt many like them who were upset by the growing traffic in the air, though one hopes not many chickens flew themselves into walls, the Cosbys of the world would find it very hard to unite and stop the idea and the technology that the Wright brothers had birthed. The Wright brothers spat airplanes into the technological meme pool. The idea then spread like a virus in a chicken coop. Farmers like the Cosbys found themselves surrounded by what seemed reasonable given the technology that the Wrights had produced. They could stand on their farms, dead chickens in hand, and shake their fists at these newfangled technologies all they wanted, They could call their representatives or even file a lawsuit. But in the end, the force of what seems obvious to everyone else, the power of common sense, would prevail. Their private interest would not be allowed to defeat an obvious public gain.
Fare thee well, don't you cry, bye-bye.
There's not a generation gap. I have to take issue with that. There's not a generation gap about stealing. If you take something that doesn't belong to you without paying for it or without permission, that's stealing. Any way you look at it, we haven't invented technology that makes the concept of it being wrong to steal. We haven't invented technology that makes that concept go away.
True or false?
Any way you look at it, we haven't invented technology that makes the concept of it being wrong to steal. We haven't invented technology that makes that concept go away.
True or false?
Wash your brains. Think again. Double check.
There's no single inventor of the internet, nor is there any good date upon which to mark its birth. Yet, in a very short time, the internet has become part of ordinary American life. According to the Pew Internet and American Life Project, 58% of Americans had access to the internet in 2002, up from 49% 2 years before. That number could well exceed two-thirds of the nation by the end of 2004. As the internet has been integrated into ordinary life, it has changed things. Some of these changes are technical. The internet has made communication faster, it has lowered the cost of gathering data, and so on. These technical changes are not the focus of this book. They are important, they are not well understood, but they are the sort of thing that would simply go away if we all just switched the internet off. They don't affect people who don't use the internet, or at least they don't affect them directly. They are the proper subject of a book about the internet, but this is not a book about the internet. Instead, this book is about an effect of the internet beyond the internet itself, an effect upon how culture is made. My claim is that the internet has induced an important and unrecognized change in that process. That change will radically transform a tradition that is as old as the Republic itself. Most, if they recognized this change, would reject it. Yet, most don't even see the change that the internet has introduced. We can glimpse a sense of this change by distinguishing between commercial and non-commercial culture, and by mapping the laws, regulation of each. By commercial culture, I mean that part of our culture that is produced and sold, or produced to be sold. By non-commercial culture, I mean all the rest. When old men sat around parks, or on street corners telling stories that kids and others consumed, that was non-commercial culture. When Noah Webster published his Reader, or Joel Barlow his poetry, that was commercial culture. At the beginning of our history, and for just about the whole of our tradition, non-commercial culture was essentially unregulated. Of course, if your stories were lewd, or if your song disturbed the peace, then the law might intervene. But the law was never directly concerned with the creation or spread of this form of culture, and it left this culture free. The ordinary ways in which ordinary individuals shared and transformed their culture, telling stories, reenacting scenes from plays or TV, participating in fan clubs, sharing music, making tapes, were left alone by the law. The focus of the law was on commercial creativity. At first slightly, then quite extensively, the law protected the incentives of creators by granting them exclusive rights to their creative work, so that they could sell those exclusive rights in a commercial marketplace. This is also, of course, an important part of creativity and culture, and it has become an increasingly important part in America. But in no sense was it dominant within our tradition. It was instead just one part, a controlled part, balanced with the free. This rough divide between the free and the controlled has now been erased. The internet has set the stage for this erasure, and pushed by big media, the law has now affected it. For the first time in our tradition, the ordinary ways in which individuals create and share culture fall within the reach of the regulation of the law, which has expanded to draw within its control a vast amount of culture and creativity that it never reached before.
Yeah, Vogue is one of the pop industry's top-selling stars, but a CD of her music could cost her fans around $20 in record stores. Many of them might be tempted to avoid paying that price tag. It is possible to download a Kylie Minogue CD or any other kind of music with just a few clicks, free of charge from the internet.
The technology that preserved the balance of our history between uses of our culture that were free and uses of our culture that were only upon permission has been undone.
But unless it's from an authorized site, it's illegal.
The consequence is that we are less and less a free culture, more and more a permission culture.
Right, I'm logging onto the computer now, and the computer is just booting up. In a few minutes, it'll eventually connect to the internet. I've got broadband connection, so it's really fast, and it's always on. So I don't have to dial up using a modem or anything like that. It just means I can download at quite a high speed.
Can you do that?
This computer user explained to me how music could be downloaded from a website onto compact discs. It's known as swapping or sharing files.
This change gets justified as necessary to protect commercial creativity, and indeed, protectionism is precisely its motivation. But the protectionism that justifies the changes that I will describe below is not the limited and balanced sort that has defined the law in the past. This is not a protectionism to protect artists. It is instead a protectionism to protect certain forms of business. Corporations threatened by the potential of the internet to change the way both commercial and non-commercial culture are made and shared have united to induce lawmakers to use the law to protect them.
I'm just going to launch Nero, which is a CD burning software.
Can you do that?
I use. I've previously loaded a file from the internet which has some music on it, and I'm going to actually record that onto a CD.
Can you do that?
I've got Nero working now. I'm going to go in and compile a new CD. It'll be an audio CD. And then I just have to select the tracks that I want and put them onto the CD.
Can you do that?
My dear sweet child, that's what I do. It's what I live for.
It's technically simple, but downloading tracks that are protected by copyright is considered theft.
It is the story of RCA and Armstrong. It is the dream of the Cosbys. For the internet has unleashed an extraordinary possibility for many to participate in the process of building and cultivating a culture that reaches far beyond local boundaries. That power has changed the marketplace for making and cultivating culture generally, and that change in turn threatens established content industries. The internet is thus to the industries that built and distributed content in the 20th century what FM radio was to AM radio, or what the truck was to the railroad industry of the 19th century.
Mama loves her baby. Daddy loves you too. And the sea may look warm to you, baby. Sky may look blue.
Dragging behind you.
because of the end, or at least a substantial transformation. Digital technologies tied to the internet could produce a vastly more competitive and vibrant market for building and cultivating culture.
Nevertheless, illicit copying from the internet has mushroomed, and Jay Berman, chairman of the International Federation of Phonographic Industries, says it's had a devastating impact on his industry.
Because
we know that millions of people simultaneously are sharing billions of unauthorized files.
You slip out of your depth and out of your mind, with your fear flowing out behind you.
It doesn't take a scientist to conclude that the volume must have an adverse effect on our business. Last 3 years, as this illegal file sharing has grown, our business has steadily declined.
That market could include a much wider and more diverse range of creators. Those creators could produce and distribute a much more vibrant range of creativity. And depending on a few important factors, those creators could earn more on average from this system than creators do today, all so long as the RCAs of our day don't use the law to protect themselves against this competition. Yet, as I argue in the pages that follow, that is precisely what is happening in our culture today. These modern-day equivalents of the early 20th century radio or 19th century railroads are using their power to get the law to protect them against this new, more efficient, more vibrant technology for building culture. They are succeeding in their plan to remake the internet before the internet remakes them.
In fact, CD sales in the US alone are estimated to have fallen by 30% since 2000. Having tried and failed over a number of years to stop illicit copying, the recording industry took the unprecedented step this month of suing more than 200 individuals in the United States, including a 12-year-old girl. Jay Berman believes such tactics are right.
Would the store, whether it's Virgin Megastore or Tower, think that the person who stuffed his overcoat with 20 CDs and walked out without paying was his consumer? I doubt it.
Kenny says you can download music for free on the internet.
Really?
Woo! You got a computer?
Record companies, listen to this song. Humans sitting on their asses getting rich. But look, I found a new game to play. I burned my first MS3 to tag. Get what I want, just won't pay.
doesn't seem this way to many. Battles over copyright and the internet seem remote to most. To the few who follow them, they seem mainly about a much simpler brace of questions. Whether piracy will be permitted, and whether property will be protected.
I doubt that any other legitimate retail establishment in the world would think of that person as its consumer.
But the industry's aggressive gesture hasn't gone down well with music fans. This student at the University of California believes the price of compact discs is artificially inflated in the first place and puts his favorite groups beyond the reach of his pockets.
I would probably buy CDs if there was like $5, you know what I'm saying? But I mean, for the record companies to make these CDs, they mass produce them, it can't cost them more than like 20 cents a CD. They're selling for $20, you know? It's kind of like a slap in the face, you know what I'm saying?
I think the CD was hugely important, but I think that we really haven't felt the full impact of what it represents, which is that it represents this transition into digitization. It represents the transition where music becomes ones and zeros. It's the first step in that direction. And, you know, I think that it's absolutely correct to say that the portability and the flexibility that the CD offered music listeners, that's the key thing. Because if we look at what's popular right now in terms of digital music, what a lot of kids are doing and a lot of adults as well, and files, downloading those, the key attraction to those, yeah, you know, a lot of people in the music industry say that it's because they're free and you can get them through these peer-to-peer file trading networks online. That's part of the attraction, but I think a big part of the attraction to the people who I've spoken to over the past few years as I've reported on these issues is the fact that they can move them around, the fact that they can take them anywhere, and MP3 files sometimes don't even sound as good as cassettes did.
It seems kind of bizarre to me, actually. I think it's very strange for a company that an organization that represents such a schmoozy business to be kind of running for Grinch the way the RIA has been for the past 5 years or so.
But it says, the industry says, and individual companies that are members of the RIAA say that people have been getting for free what they're trying to sell in stores, and their options on how to stop it are pretty limited. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, people hear the radio for free as well.
So it is that flexibility that the digital medium offers us, the fact that now we can burn CDs of our favorite songs at home. I mean, you could never cut an LP at home.
In 83, I was in eighth grade, and I was basically a budding audiophile. And when CDs came out, I was the first, you know, I absolutely had to have it. And I thought, well, that will put my LPs away forever. But that didn't ring true in the sense that there's one group that the Beatle albums, to me, sound better on vinyl. You just have to have that contact of a stylus, you know, rubbing against the vinyl for some reason. So.
Because...
it's a fact. Abbey Road is impossible to listen to for me on a CD. But, so, I mean, they certainly are great, on some groups, but for me, they just never could capture what the Beatles put out.
Because...
Thank you.
that has been waged against the technologies of the Internet. What Motion Picture Association of America, MPAA, President Jack Valenti calls, quote, his own terrorist war, unquote, has been framed as a battle about the rule of law and respect for property. Know which side to take in this war, most think that we need only decide whether we're for property or against it. If those really were the choices, then I would be with Jack Valenti and the content industry. I, too, am a believer in property, and especially in the importance of what Mr. Valenti nicely calls creative property. I believe that piracy is wrong, and that the law, properly tuned, should punish piracy, whether on or off the Internet. But those simple beliefs mask a much more fundamental question and a much more dramatic change. My fear is that unless we come to see this change, the war to rid the world of Internet pirates will also rid our culture of values that have been integral to our tradition from the start.
By its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress?
These values built a tradition that for at least the first 180 years of our republic guaranteed creators the right to build freely upon their past and protected creators and innovators from either state or private control. The First Amendment protected creators against state control, and as Professor Neil Nathanael powerfully argues, copyright law properly balanced protected creators against private control. Our tradition was thus neither Soviet nor the tradition of patrons. It instead carved out a wide berth within which creators could cultivate and extend our culture. Yet the law's response to the Internet, when tied to changes in the technology of the Internet itself, has massively increased the effective regulation of creativity in America. To build upon or critique the culture around us, one must ask, Oliver Twist-like, for permission first. Permission is, of course, often granted, but it is not often granted to the critical or the independent.
Sits in his 37th floor suite and swivels to gaze down at the city he made me in. He allows me to stand and solicit graffiti until he needs the land I stand on. And I, in my darkened threshold, am pawing through my pockets the receipts, the bus schedules, urgent napkin poems, and matchbook phone numbers, all of which laundering is rendered pulpy and strange loose change. The key asks me.
I'm a musician. Music's my life. My favorite bands, they come out with records and they have concerts. I can't buy their records and I can't see their concerts because their fans are kind of moaning, you know.
Some record companies are starting to lower prices in an effort to lure more customers into stores and away from the Internet.
You may be missing out on something.
But critics like rock star David Bowie say there's not much point in cutting prices on CDs at the same time as carrying out high-profile legal action against some customers.
You may be missing out on something.
He thinks the record industry is in danger of alienating the very people it wants to attract.
You may be missing out on something.
And at the rate we're moving ahead,
Century 21 is coming up fast.
Because I think once corporations start suing their consumers and their customers, they're really on a slippery slope. Got this strange push-pull thing happening now in the recording industry. The recording industry is saying, well, we're going to made the prices on our product cheaper. You know, we're going to sell cheap CDs at a much cheaper price, therefore kind of admitting that the CDs are kind of that are too expensive anyway. And on the other hand, they're also suing the same consumers. So I think it's I think they've got themselves into a very tough battle in this one.
It's not clear whether the industry's tactics of suing individuals will work in the long run. In the past, it's had limited success in protecting its copyright.
Certain undescribable difference about analog, that's something that holds true to today. And the fact of the matter is that we still have many people who really embrace analog technology for a certain quality that it imparts to music. And I guess one of the things about it is what it imparts is a certain lack of accuracy in its reproduction, and that's something that is in some ways elegant about analog records, and that that you get that certain something extra that is, in essence is error in an analog recording. Well, and that's definitely one of the things about digital technology, too. I mean, you can, as we at NPR know, because we've used analog technology up until really recently.
So we have.
And you can slightly distort analog, and it does sound good. If you slightly distort digital, it sounds terrible, absolutely. But I think there's also something to be said for the fact that analog is the way we've all learned to listen to music. We understand that recorded music sounds like analog. Now, that may not be true for people under the age of 20 because they've grown up with the digital technology, but I think those of us who are older and who grew up with LPs, 45s, cassettes, and whatnot, that's the way we hear music, so that's what we like.
And in some ways, I think a lot of artists have realized that the MP3 format is a great way to promote what they're doing, especially if they don't have unlimited access to the radio or MTV. I mean, it's a way for people to stay in touch with recording artists. I think the RIAA has a valid point. They're losing a lot of business, but I'm not entirely sure that it's a battle that they're really going to be able to win. I think they're losing valuable time catching up with technology and figuring out where the industry really needs to go next.
Well,
we have built a kind of cultural nobility. Those within the noble class live easily, those outside it don't.
4 years ago, a pioneering software burst onto the internet music scene. Napster allowed people to swap music tracks with each other free of charge.
Where do you cross the line between promotions? And as you say, I mean, the radio has been seen as a tool for getting right. People to like new artists since there's been radio. Between promotion and then foregoing people who would otherwise go into a store and buy a recording.
Got too close, somebody came on too heavy. Now look at me, met ugly by the drooling letters. I was better off alone, ain't that the way it is? They don't know the first thing, but you don't know that till they take the first swing. My fingers are red and swollen from the cold. I'm getting bold in my old age, so they try the door. It doesn't matter anymore. No, the weak heart of the strong will are we being kept alive until we're killed. He's up there. Clinking in his glass, he sends us little pieces of paper and ask. I just empty my pockets and wait.
don't fool myself with romance. I just live phone number, dusting them against my thighs and the mark in my pockets, which whisper history incessantly asking me, where were you?
But it is nobility of any form that is alien to our tradition. The story that follows is about this war. It is not about the centrality of technology to ordinary life. I don't believe in gods, digital or otherwise.
There is no God!
Nor is it an effort to demonize any individual or group, for neither do I believe in a devil, corporate or otherwise. It is not a morality tale, nor is it a call to jihad against an industry.
The music industry was slow to respond.
It is instead an effort to understand a hopelessly destructive war inspired by the technologies of the internet, but reaching far beyond its code. By understanding this battle, it is an effort to map peace. There is no good reason for the current struggle around internet technologies to continue. There will be great harm to our tradition and culture if it is allowed to continue unchecked. We must come to understand the source of this war. We must resolve it soon. Like the Cosby's battle, this war is in part about property. The property of this war is not as tangible as the Cosby's, and no innocent chicken has yet to lose its life. Yet the ideas surrounding this property are as obvious to most as the Cosbys' claim about the sacredness of their farm was to them. We are the Cosbys. Most of us take for granted the extraordinarily powerful claims that the owners of intellectual property now assert. Most of us, like the Cosbys, treat these claims as obvious. And hence, we, like the Cosbys, object when a new technology interferes with this property. It is as plain to us as it was to them that the new technologies of the internet are trespassing upon legitimate claims of property. It is as plain to us as it was to them that the law should intervene to stop this trespass.
Now we're going to hear the real dope from Washington.
And thus, when geeks and technologists defend their Armstrong or Wright brothers' technology, most of us are simply unsympathetic. Common sense does not revolt. Unlike in the case of the unlucky Cosbys, common sense is on the side of the property owners in this war. Unlike the lucky Wright brothers, the internet has not inspired a revolution on its side.
Now we're going to hear the real dope from Washington.
My hope is to push this common sense along. I have become increasingly amazed by the power of intellectual property, and more importantly, its power to disable critical thought by policymakers and citizens. There's never been a time in our history when more of our culture was as owned as it is now. And yet, there has never been a time when the concentration of power to control the uses of culture has been as unquestioningly accepted as it is now.
And I'm here to announce in front of everyone, we're still going to download music free off of the internet.
Above the law and the law one. Above the law and the law one. Above the law and the law one.
And there's not a thing anyone can do about it.
Everyone on the internet copies music from their CDs, and then we can download them for free and play them on the computer.
All right, cool. Let's download some Metallica and some Stevie Wonder.
Oh,
Kitty's right, we should download some Judas Priest, too. Judas Priest. Wow, downloading music for free is awesome. What the hell is that? I don't know. Let me check the...
Freeze, FBI! Down on the ground! Down on the ground! me see those hands! Tango team is at Point Bravo. Suspect's in custody.
But as internet analyst Mark Mulligan points out, it was not the end of the problem.
The record industry has effectively destroyed the online competition to start building again. Unfortunately, the illegal file sharing world got back on its feet straight away and is there all over again. This is pretty much like hitting some monster in a science fiction film and it's splattering into 20 little pieces, running away and coming back each as big as the last one.
As it did with Napster, the recording industry is pursuing these software services through the courts. But the civil liberties group Internet Freedom says legal action is a waste of time.
I believe it would be right for common sense to revolt against the extreme claims made today on behalf of intellectual property. What the law demands today is increasingly as silly as the sheriff arresting an airplane for trespass. But the consequences of this silliness will be much more profound. The struggle that rages just now centers on two ideas, piracy and property. My aim in this book's next two parts is to explore these two ideas. My method is not the usual method of an academic. I don't want to plunge you into a complex argument buttressed with references to obscure French theorists, however natural that is for the weird sort we academics have become. Instead, I begin in each part with a collection of stories that set a context within which these apparently simple ideas can be more fully understood. The two sections set up the core claim of this book, that while the internet has indeed produced something fantastic and new, our government, pushed by big media to respond to this something new, is destroying something very old.
I am a member of an agency of the federal government, charged with making sure that we have enough openness and diversity in our media and our telecommunication systems to enable that dialogue and to sustain that dialogue. And I think this audience understands far better than most how integral communications are to our political and civic dialogue. But I have to tell you today that I believe it is all at risk. And I have to tell you that I believe we are playing fast and loose with basic principles that we should change only for very good reason and only after thorough national debate and discussion about what's at stake. And what I see at the FCC is a shift, really a tectonic shift, in policymaking across the whole broad range of telecommunications issues and media issues too. From media to telecom, now to the internet and beyond, we are rushing, I think, toward breathtaking change in our regulatory policy. And this commission strikes me as permitting, even encouraging, competition to wither in the face of consolidation. And I think it's on the road to replace open networks with closed systems. And I think in the process, it is shortchanging the public interest.
Rather than understanding the changes the internet might permit, and rather than taking time to let common sense resolve how best to respond, we are allowing those most threatened by the changes to use their power to change the law, and more importantly, to use their power to change something fundamental about who we have always been. We allow this, I believe, not because it is right, and not because most of us really believe in these changes. We allow it because the interests most threatened are among the most powerful players in our depressingly compromised process of making law.
It believes that people have a right to exchange information over the net, and that the music industry is trying to maintain total control over people's listening habits.
You downloaded a lot of songs. It says here you even downloaded Judas Priest. That's hard time you boys are looking at. You got anything to say for yourselves?
We didn't think it was that big a deal.
Not a big deal? You think downloading music for free is not a big deal? Put your coats on. I'm gonna show you something. And I don't think you're gonna like it. This is the home of Lars Ulrich, the drummer from Metallica. Look, there's Lars now, sitting by his pool.
What's the matter with him?
This month he was hoping to have a gold-plated Shark Tank bar installed right next to the pool. But thanks to people downloading his music for free, he must now wait a few months before he can afford it.
How about trying this future on for size?
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
Well, it's one for the money.
Spectators, but not participants.
You can't legislate people's behavior.
We don't mind when our fans pay money to wear our promotional t-shirts. And it's fine when they pay $40 to come to one of our concerts. When our fans think they can listen to our music for free, they just cross the line.
Really? Woo! You got a computer?
I'm not even sure that's legal.
You know, we could, like, go to jail for this.
Copyrighted things, man.
But everybody does it.
Copyright requirements.
I'm not even sure that's legal.
Old company.
Then let the thief, the government is.
Copyright requirements.
I'm not even sure that's legal.
You're encouraged and hired after it. Old company.
I mean, we're stealing as we speak.
You know, we could, like, go to jail for this.
I'm not even sure that's legal.
I mean, we're stealing as we speak.
Yes.
Don't you remember the Eighth Commandment?
Yes. Thou shalt not steal.
Yes.
Thou shalt not steal.
Yes.
Thou shalt not steal.
Yes.
Thou shalt not steal.
Yes.
Are you sure this is legal?
U.S. copyright law. The U.S. copyright law. The U.S. copyright law.
You mean the U.S. copyright law?
Yes.
Yo! Psycho! Psycho of greed! Psycho of greed!
The people!
Psycho!
What?
Psycho of greed!
The people!
Psycho! What?
Yeah!
Psycho of greed!
The people!
Psycho!
The people! What?
People! Psycho of greed!
What motherfucking people,
Chuck, man?
Big business, doing big business, only with big business. What is this?
Go, 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 go,
man.
Go, 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 go.
Who can't be heard or seen on the radio or TV screens, know what I mean? Fuck the poor, say the kings and queens who stuff themselves behind castle doors. While the masses are starving them asses, shoot out behind VIP glasses. Bomb the lower classes, have the cops harass us. The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho.
The people. Universal sequel, controlling their mind, bodies, all their souls. Viacom bombs them with BET, MTV, and the goddamn radio. Big business stole the culture, gives you all the platinum, diamonds, and the gold. Minds with brothers died, so niggas come back with Glocks and nines. Minds with brothers died, so niggas come back with Glocks and nines. Minds with brothers died, so niggas come back with Glocks and nines. The people. The people. The people. The people. Cycle.
Cycle.
Of greed.
Cycle of greed.
Cycle.
Cycle.
Of greed.
Cycle of greed.
The people.
Cycle.
Cycle.
Cycle of greed.
Of greed.
Cycle.
Cycle.
Cycle of cycles. Feed off the innocent life cycles. Feed scenes to drop seeds, murdering the minds of the ones they need to feed. The ones that read the misdeeds and bleed. From the cycles, cycle of greed.
It's 9 o'clock, working class, it's the grind at 5 o'clock. To maintain and stay alive, to keep from falling off below the minimum wage. I gotta pay for my J.O.B. at a penitentiary. Thin line between me and slavery. All the new slaves look like me behind the stars, behind the VIP. Making fun out of me, or making money off of me. But new shorties make a new sport out of cats like me. Coming up missing, 2001, jacking rappers is like new fishing. What?
Psycho of greed.
Psycho.
Psycho.
Of greed.
Psycho of greed. Psycho.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
Psycho.
Psycho.
Of greed.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho.
Psycho.
Psycho of greed.
Of greed.
Psycho.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
Psycho.
Psycho.
Of greed.
Psycho of greed.
Come on.
Psycho.
Psycho.
Psycho of greed.
Of greed.
Psycho.
Cycle.
Psycho of greed.
Of greed.
Psycho.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho of greed.
The people.
Psycho of greed.